Sounds of Leah Scallon and the sounds of Sirius. And Leah has gifted us her beautiful music to be the theme song of Utopia International 2009. So we really thank Leah for that beautiful gift. And today we have the lovely Molly Carlisle, who's come to speak with us. Molly is also one of the Utopia International Retreat presenters and Master of Ceremonies at Utopia International Retreat. And Molly, are you there?
I'm here.
Fabulous. Good to hear your voice, because you have been away travelling. You've been a very busy person. And it's lovely to have you in the chair for the to share with us what you're going to be doing at Utopia this year.
So, well, it's lovely to be here.
Indeed, lovely to be home, I dare say. Back in good old Australia after your big adventure, because you've had a fabulous year since Utopia. You've been on your Churchill scholarship tour. And
yes.
I know you've done your report. You might even just like to tell us a little bit about your trip, just to set the scene.
Okay. Well, I received a Churchill Fellowship last year in 2008, and my fellowship was around looking at utilising the arts to help communities to talk about death, grief and loss, and how we could use the arts to create a safe space for those conversations to happen, because people, by and large, avoid talking about death and grief because it has a whole lot of implications around our own mortality and our capacity to support others, etc. And my view has always been that if we can build up strong, informed support networks in local communities, then it will be the local community who supports the grieving person. It won't necessarily be specialist counsellors or psychologists or palliative care workers coming in and imposing therapies onto people who are grieving. So that was the aim of my fellowship, and I went to America and attended the International Society for Arts and Health conference, which was wonderful. And then I went and visited a number of programs in America in big, huge health services. You know, some of them have 1,400 beds in their acute services, so they're enormous. And then I went from America to England and visited a number of services there, both inpatient-based services and community services. And then I went to Ireland, and amazingly in Ireland, it's a long time since I've done hands-on clinical palliative care work, and I was really lucky that I went out for a day with one of the nurses from the Cavan office, which is right up on the border of of the Republic and Northern Ireland, and went and visited a couple of clients who lived in quite isolated areas, which was just extraordinary. It was fantastic. So I saw lots of stuff, visited lots of cemeteries, lots of cathedrals, lots of art galleries, all of which are part of the process because, you know, we've used the arts since civilization started to tell stories, and that's really the focus of what I was doing. So that's that. That's what I did.
Nice. And that fits in very nicely with what you're going to be doing at Utopia as well, because your keynote is titled, "I'm Sorry, But You're Not Grieving Properly." You might like to tell us
exactly
a little bit about that, because that sounds fascinating.
Well, you know, that links back into what I was saying about specialist providers falling into the trap sometimes of imposing a model of dying and grieving on people that we think is the right way they should be doing it. But contemporary grief theory tells us quite clearly that even though there are similarities in how people may choose to grieve and the types of responses they may have, there's no one single pathway that you can anticipate someone will follow. So everyone grieves differently, and they grieve differently based on their relationship with the person who's died. So, you know, even if you've had four or five significant deaths in your life of people close to you, each time you will probably grieve a bit differently to the time before because your relationship with that person was different to the last person. So, for example, you will grieve differently if you have a partner who dies versus a parent versus a child, and you'll grieve differently based on the circumstances of the death. So some people find someone who dies slowly over a period of time is easier for them to handle because they have more time to get used to the idea that the person's dying. But for others, that can actually be a complex thing because there's no stringent timeline between the person being alive and being dead. You know, they deteriorate over time, and there's that whole thing about they have a day that's really bad and everyone comes in and stands around the bed waiting for them to die, and then they sort of pick up and everyone goes back to normal again. And then the next time there's some sort of deterioration, everyone has to come rushing in again, and they all get anxious about this is going to be it. And then the person may pick up again. So you can see that for some, that prolonged dying can be an opportunity to come to terms with the imminent death. But for others, it can be a complication. And the same thing happens like if someone dies suddenly. For some people, they will really struggle with that because the reality of the death takes them a long time to get used to, particularly if they haven't been able to view the body or spend time with the person recently. And so a phone call comes out of the blue to say someone's dropped dead at work. That can be extremely distressing for people because of the nature of how the death occurred in addition to the loss of the person. So there's no one way of grieving, and there's no way of predicting how someone will respond. And, you know, that's the sort of stuff that I'll be talking about. What things are the common elements that are incorporated in the grieving process, and where may people's past experience influence how they grieve the next time round?
And for anybody that's listening, coming straight into this conversation, you're going to think, wow, Molly goes straight into this really quickly. And having had dinner with Molly, lots of lunches, lots of fun times with Molly, this is a normal conversation that you always have with Molly. Molly is passionate about her topic. Hysterical. And her passion comes through her work so strongly, because of course you have a huge nursing background yourself, and you've actually managed to meld very beautifully the spiritual aspect. You're a Reiki master. You've done Molly and I met at the beautiful Simone Matthews Essence of Angel course. And we did crystal light healing together as well. And the pair of us were sitting up the back like two naughty school kids, tapped into source, asking Simone all of these wonderful, weird and wonderful questions that we were getting as we were doing the crystal light healing course, until Simone decided we'd have morning tea and broke the team up. But it was very funny, wasn't it? It was hysterical. Yeah. It was just... Two kindred spirits met, and it was just amazing. But Molly is absolutely passionate about what she does. But Molly, you've managed to meld your spiritual interest, your deep spiritual interest. You're like me. You have quite a business side, but you've also got the spiritual side, which you've melded very well into your work. You might like to tell us a little bit about that as well, because it's my pet topic, is that business and spirituality doesn't have to be different, and you've managed to meld it with grieving and death and really being of service to people at a time when they most need support. You might like to tell us a little bit about that.
I guess I'm lucky, Marg, in that, you know, working with dying people is a great teacher, because it makes you cast off all of those superfluous things that seem to take up 90% of your time in normal day-to-day living, and focus in on the important stuff. And I've got to say, I've never, ever been with a dying person who said to me, gosh, I wish I'd spent more time on meetings, or I wish I'd bought a bigger car or bought a bigger house. The things that are imperative for people when they're under stress is how they make sense of the world inside, so the spiritual world, their personal spiritual world, and how they convey that to the world on the outside. And so I've had to explore the spiritual element in order to be able to communicate on that level with patients and families. And for me, it very much comes back to living, or trying to live, a life of integrity. And certainly in the environment in which I work, particularly in mainstream health, we have been historically fearful of the emotional and the psychological and the spiritual elements of care, because it means we have to look inwards. And we're very practiced at looking outwards, and looking at the minutiae, mm-hmm. and research based on the most tiny of physical things, but we're not very good at looking at the stuff that makes us think and makes us feel. And I learnt that very early on, that is the stuff that the patients are interested in, not what the latest double randomised control trial results are. They're interested in being able to talk about what's happening for them right now, and having someone with whom they can have that conversation, because oftentimes they don't have the confidence to initiate those conversations with family. And I've always seen my role as being a conduit for that to happen, so that the dying person has a safe space to talk about the scary stuff with me, and that then I can create an opportunity then for them to feel more confident about having those conversations with the people that they love. And it's not just about giving them permission to have those conversations, but it's about providing, being a catalyst for those conversations to happen. And so part of that process is that, of course, it has an impact on you personally as a healthcare provider or a health professional, a complementary therapist, whatever environment you work in. There is a personal cost to that unless you invest in your own self-awareness, your own self-knowledge, your own self-care. because that's how you make sense of the experiences that you're surrounded with every day. And that's where, you know, Reiki and crystal light healing and working with angel therapy, that's where all of those things have assisted me from a personal perspective to make sense out of the clinical environment I often find myself in.
Mm. And I know your workshop. I know we spoke about this. I'm not exactly certain what's in your workshop, but it's, I don't know what's wrong with me. You're going to be sharing some of these things with therapists. I know that was the original thought for your workshop, which is on the Sunday, I believe.
Yeah.
You might like to tell
well,
us a little more
really
about
the
that.
The workshop's about picking up on some of the issues I touched on last year around self-awareness and self-knowledge and self-regulation. And for those of you who were at Utopia last year, I spoke about those things in and offered the framework of Goleman's emotional intelligence competencies, because that's what this comes back to. Having an understanding of yourself is around being emotionally and spiritually intelligent, as opposed to being intelligent in a cognitive sense. Mm-hmm. So the workshop is going to look at how we can provide the best possible level of grief support to clients, to family, to our social circle, without it actually being a cost to us personally. And giving participants permission, really, to connect in with their innate humanity. Because we all have the capacity to empathise and to be compassionate. But sometimes we're too scared that we're going to say the wrong thing. And often it's about pulling that apart a little bit and saying, okay, so what happens if I do say the wrong thing? How can I repair that? And what is the wrong thing? And why would saying a certain thing be wrong? For example, if you ask someone a question and they burst into tears, is that a reason to retreat? I would suggest it's not. It's a reason to sit in a space, because you've actually given that person an opportunity to talk about what's happening to them right now, and that's why they felt comfortable enough to cry. And yet for most of us, as soon as someone cries, we think, oh my God, I shouldn't have said that, and we try and backstep, you know.
And shut it down, yeah.
Yeah. And so the workshop's going to be, it's going to be very interactive. We're going to do some stuff, some exercises around putting ourselves in situations in a controlled environment where we can experience this in safety and practice some skills that people can then take away with them and incorporate into their practice. And part of that will be, where does my level of professional expertise start and finish? What are the triggers that will happen in a therapeutic relationship between me and a client that should make the alarms go off for me and highlight to me the need to pull in a specialist to support this person? So what are the things that are part of a process that's working, and where are the alarm bells? You know, so if someone's talking about their experience and they impart to you, you know, thoughts of self-harm or suicide, etc., how can you address that at the point that it's occurring and then pull in reinforcements to support that person to work through that specific stuff that maybe you're not equipped to work with? Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are the assessment strategies that we can use to identify when complex grief responses are happening for somebody?
Beautiful. Because I guess up until now, a lot of the interviews have with some of the people we have a very high spiritual content, you know, very, very of interest to therapists. the things that really get therapists going, like, you know, orbs and channeling and things like that. Yours is very practical and something that can be used in their practice and used to further their personal development. And this is an aspect that hasn't come through strongly yet about Utopia. I sit in the same space as you do, Molly, in that I'm there to further the personal development of the people attending. And I think this is one of the gifts of Utopia. It has many, many different aspects to it. And you're not only going there for the fabulous, I'll use the word woo-woo in a very loose context, because it's not light or fluffy by any means. It's deep healing information, and we are hearing from some of the cutting-edge healers on the planet, actually, at Utopia this year. We're going to be hearing some of the more advanced techniques that people can take in, but we're also giving some very, very practical and very hands-on information, and yours in particular, Molly, is going to give therapists and people like coaches. I know we've got a lot of coaches coming. People from even your industry, Molly, are coming. Nurses, people right on the front line, you're going to be giving them some very, very practical tools, which I think it's nice that we're starting to bring in some of the other aspects of Utopia now. And you were there last year, Molly. What was your feeling from last year?
Look, I think people come with a whole range of different expectations and different personal objectives. You know, some people come because they need a break, because the year has been extraordinarily busy, and I've got to put my hand up for that too, because I'm really looking forward.
I've just been speaking to Simone Matthews, and you know, she's just been doing so many workshops and appearing everywhere. I think all of us, and Sue Coombs, the other co-presenter of Utopia, we have just been workshopping and presenting our little hearts out. It's like the universe has stepped us up a notch and gone, go out and spread the news. And everybody has. So that resting aspect is going to be huge, I think, at Utopia this year, and nurturing.
Absolutely. I must say I'm really looking forward to that. But from the other perspective, I guess for me, that marriage between the internal world and the high-end work, and being able to apply that in a practical sense. I mean, we can't all be mystics who hide ourselves in a cave and meditate for 40 years. We have to function in a very demanding physical world, and we're all here at the minute because we've made that choice. Therefore, we can't just hide away. We have to be interacting with the world around us all the time. And so I see our role very much as bringing in that healing energy, bringing in the intuition and applying it in a practical sense. And it's not just people who work with patients or clients who deal with dying and grief. I mean, we're all going to die. We all have significant deaths occur in our family and friendship circles. And the better we equipped we are, each of us, to support and nurture the people around us, the better outcomes happen, you know. Yes. So I guess that's pretty much my focus, Marg, that people will be able to take away some really practical tools that they can use on a personal basis, and then in their professional lives, but also in their social and family lives.
Mm. And I guess that's an interesting point you touch on there, is that as the healers, who heals the healers, it's the ultimate question. Often when we're dealing with grief, people look at you and go, oh, but you're the strong one, you have to be the strong one. So it's really good that you are giving permission for people to go into their healing process, whatever is appropriate for them, and not as the healer, not have to be the stoic one that, you know, that just gets on with it and covers up all of the feelings that they're having and just get on with it, you know, because you're always the strong one. Well, actually, you're giving them tools that are going to allow them to work through their grief in many different ways, because I believe that's important. I sometimes think, I often get that myself. If I'm having a bit of a down moment, somebody's there going, oh, but you're always a strong one. And we as healers and as therapists and as coaches and people of anybody of service, really, we also need to be able to understand how to self-nurture, how to self-care, how to grieve appropriately for us, not as anybody else would be putting it on us. So you're going to be really offering some amazing tools. And Molly, you're also our Master of Ceremonies.
Oh, I am. I'm the ringleader. The circus master.
You are the circus master, and you did it beautifully last year. Poor Molly, whenever you saw her, she was here. A big handful of papers in her hand, rushing trying to get somebody somewhere, or a big group of people. I know one of your biggest challenges, Molly, was the morning teas, because everybody found a new friend at morning tea, and it was always difficult to get them in for the next session, and difficult to get them out of that session once they'd experienced it. So you did an amazing job and kept everybody to time, and it was just great. It was you did an amazing job, and this year's going to be no different. So, Molly, this year, Utopia, 16th to the 18th of October, not long to go now. I know that the early bird price is running out pretty quickly. 31st of August 2009 is the end of the early bird. So we're really encouraging everybody to get in there, get their tickets. We've already got a lot of people who've already signed up and are booked in. I do know that there is a bit of a booking situation at the resort at the moment. You're going to need to be in quick if you want to be at the resort. So book there. But the good news is a few steps down the road, there's another resort, which Sue Coombs will tell you about, that has plenty of rooms available, and it's just a very short step. And I do believe some of the presenters may even be down there as well. But we're all going to be on site at Australis as we were last year. I think, Molly, did you enjoy that everybody was just all in together?
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, I really loved that. And you know, the great thing is, I speak at a lot of conferences, Marg, and, you know, big ones. I mean, next month I'm speaking at the International Palliative Care Conference in Perth, and there's going to be 1,600 people at that. And when you have conferences of that scale, the people who are attending just don't get an opportunity to sit down and have a chat with a presenter over a cup of tea or whatever. And the beauty of Utopia is that there's no quarantining of the presenters. The presenters are part of the gang, and we are all relatively easy to talk to. I think I can speak on behalf of most of us and say that we're approachable, and you know, we're part of a gang. It's not about us telling you what to do. It's about a shared, I won't say journey, because gosh, I've watched MasterChef too much. I'm so over the journey. But it's a shared partnership between all of us. And the beauty of an environment like that is that we all learn from each other, because everybody brings something of value. And, you know, I guess it's about empowering everybody to know that what they have to say is valid and that someone else needs to hear it.
Yes.
And, yeah, that's the thing I love about Utopia.
Yeah, no, absolutely fantastic. And last year was the initial year, the first year of Utopia. And, look, this year we'll just be building on that beautiful energy. The second you walked into the room, you got that this was going to be something really, really special. Because it was the first year, we really didn't know what to expect to happen, and you walked in the room and it was just amazing. And I know Sue Coombs and Simone Matthews, the co-presenters or co-creators, co-creators of Utopia, and they are all presenting and facilitating during the weekend as well. I think that's what makes it special. They're right in there. They're absolutely right in there, and they have selected people who are working from the heart. Absolutely, that is the that is the prerequisite to speak at Utopia this year, is that you're working from the heart and that you're willing to share and willing to share for the whole weekend. So it's going to be very, very exciting. I'm going to look forward to seeing you, Molly, at Utopia, if not before. I believe that your play that you've been, I think you co-wrote the play, didn't you?
I did.
In my hometown very soon, in the next week or so, I may see you there. You might even just quickly tell people about the play.
Okay, so the play's called Four Funerals in One Day, and I co-wrote it with Alan Hopgood, who anyone from Australia who's listening to this will know Hoppy. He's been on telly since I was a little kid. He's a gorgeous man and has written lots of amazing film scripts and theatrical scripts. In fact, I only found out the other week he wrote Elven Purple, which surprised me a little bit. But anyway, so we wrote this together, and it's one of those things that we're using to try and get communities talking about death and grief. But having said that, it's not a maudlin, sad, miserable performance. It's actually very entertaining and very funny, and the whole idea around writing a play was that it needed to stand on its own two feet from an entertainment point of view. So it stands alone in being able to entertain people, but it also encourages people to think a bit more deeply about death and grief and the discussions that they've had in their families, if they've had them, and if they haven't, trying to encourage them to have those discussions before families are trying to come to terms with, you know, a terminal diagnosis or a sudden death, etc. So we launched it at the National Palliative Care Conference last year.
Mm-hmm.
No, sorry, the year before. And it's been touring around Victoria since. It's going to be performed at the International Conference next month. And we're hoping to take it internationally eventually. So it's on in Ballarat next week, isn't it, Marg?
Indeed, I do believe it's next week. So I may see you there. Otherwise, I'm going to very much look forward to seeing you at Utopia, 16th to 18th of October at Australis Resort in Noosa. How fun. And thank you so much for your time today, Molly, and sharing with us. You're getting the message that if you need to know anything about death, dying, or the grieving process, Molly is going to be the person to ask at Utopia. And I can tell you there's some interesting conversations to be had with Molly at any given time. So rock on up and ask her, have a chat, and we will look forward to seeing you there, Molly. Thank you so much.
Sure. Can I just add in, Marg, if people want to find out a little bit more about all the stuff we've been talking about, they can feel free to go to my website, which is www.mollycarlisle.com, and you'll also find some stuff about Utopia on there.
Indeed, and on the Utopia website, there's actually a link to your site as well under your beside your photo. So if you didn't get that down, folks, hop onto the Utopia website under the presenters page and you'll find Molly. I think she's about the fourth one down, and you can click directly onto that link as well. So that's perfect. Thank you for that, Molly. I forgot to do your website ID.
That's okay.
Let's look forward to seeing you at Utopia. And we will now be listening to another of the Sounds of Sirius. This one is Leah's latest CD, and it's called Song of Love for the Animals. So thanks again, Molly, and we'll look forward to seeing you there. I'm Margaret Gill of Abundant Private Practices, and we're going to look forward to speaking with some more speakers as we go to the end of the series, of the interview series for Utopia International Retreat. So stay tuned for those as well. And we're going to leave you today with Leah Scallon, the Sounds of Sirius that she channels so beautifully, and her beautiful gift of Utopia, the Song of Love for the Animals.